Radio.
Understanding the Purpose and the Drift of Contemporary Cultures. A presentation by Dr. Ian Benson at the Christopher Dawson Centre for Cultural Studies 2017 Colloquium.
Right, well, the title of my paper, as you'll see from the program, is Understanding the Purpose and Drift of Contemporary Cultures. I brought with me a couple of copies of the Acton lecture, which I gave for the Center for Independent Studies, and that was called Civic Virtues and the Politics of Full Drift Ahead. And so the common theme is this notion of drift, but I hope to be precise in describing this drift and not succumb to the same thing I'm criticizing. But I'd like to start by thanking Dr. David Daintree for the kind invitation to be part of this colloquium here in Tasmania. It's my first time to this island, and having spent a very large part of my life on islands, mostly in Canada, but also in my birth country of Scotland, it's pleasant to be back on one. But then Australia, where I've been living for a year and a half, is also an island of a sort. In any case, I'm not here to discuss islands per se today, but the drift that often occurs around islands. I shall stretch similes and perhaps, though I hope not, massacre metaphors. For islands may be seen as romantic or as terrifying and to be endured, as in Robinson Crusoe. They can be the home to communities or to isolation, as in prison colonies. And here I will speak of a different sort of isolation shared, I imagine, by some, perhaps many, in this room. I speak of the kind of isolation that comes to the contemporary scholar or thoughtful person who realizes that he or she is no longer speaking the language of those around them. In that wonderful quotation from Canadian philosopher George Grant, like Dr. Daintree, a graduate of University of Oxford, and in fact who was a student or had a fair bit to do with C.S. Lewis in his days, George Grant's days at Oxford. George Grant, well known in Canada, less outside of it, passed away in 1988. But he said this, and it's quoted in the abstract for the colloquium. He talked about values language, and that's the central theme of what I want to talk to you about again. I can't get away from this theme. It keeps dragging me back because it is so central and so critical. And I just need to get across to as many people as I can in whatever time I have at my disposal on this planet that this term values is the enemy of morality. It is not in any way a friend of morals. And I hope to convince you of that today. Grant said this, values language is an obscuring language for morality used when the idea of purpose has been destroyed. I'll repeat that. Values language is an obscuring language for morality used when the idea of purpose has been destroyed. So note what he's saying in there. It's obscuring language for morality. That is to say, it's used for morality, but it obscures it. Now, what's he saying to us? He's pointing out that the language is a false sort of moral language, a trickster, one that offers what it does not and cannot deliver. In this paper, I wish to examine further aspects of it due to its centrality in what passes for contemporary education, but is actually more schooling than education. This claim that values language actually cuts moral education off at the core will be a surprise to some here who think it is an acceptable moral language, who use it themselves in their work or even in their writing. Values language, however, is the lexical equivalent of the cuckoo's egg. Having been laid in our nest of language, sometime alongside other eggs that are used to drive religion and its moral languages to the margins of culture, and here one might mention terms such as secularism and secular in its new use, not its old use. Secularum at the times of the age didn't mean a non-religious or non-sacred sphere until roughly the same time as the term secularism was coined in 1851, that term, by George Jacob Holyoake. That's the first use that the Oxford English Dictionary gives for it. And other eggs in the lexical cuckoo's nest, more recently, progressive, equality, or inclusion. These are additional terms to note for their fledgling killing capacities. All these terms have muscled out the other fledglings, the traditional moral fledglings, such as virtues, from the nest. And these have, in effect, fallen to the ground where they have largely expired. Most have not even noticed the substitution. The fledglings may have noticed it if they were in a position to do so, but we haven't noticed it as well as we might. Fortunately for us and for liberal education, some people did notice this. C.S. Lewis, whose essay The Poison of Subjectivism a few years later became his book, probably his most important book, some think, The Abolition of Man, 1943, he noticed. Alan Bloom, whose The Closing of the American Mind made such a splash when it appeared in the early 1980s, noted both the prevalence and radically relativizing nature of the language of values. Alistair MacIntyre, in his justly celebrated After Virtue, noticed, as did John Rist, the Canadian classicist, in his fine book Real Ethics. They all noticed. Recently, Pierre Manon, writing on secularism in Europe, made the point very clearly and very powerfully that none of the virtues of France could have been developed under the rubric of republican values, the term that's being used ubiquitously in France. Yet why, and here's the question, why, after all this commentary, is this wretched, truly diabolical term still a mainstay of polite conversation, even disastrously used in courses and placed on bronze plaques in Catholic institutions, such as my own? A few years ago, where we were told that we teach according to the Catholic faith and values. A few years ago, having made the case against values to a meeting of the Pontifical Academy for Social Sciences at the Vatican, its then president, the wonderful Marianne Glendon from Harvard Law School, said, "Ian, you've made a compelling argument against values, but what are we supposed to do? We've been using this language in the church for decades." Quite. I quoted on that occasion G.K. Chesterton, who did not write about values at all, when he said that the wisest thing one can do when one realizes that one's on the wrong road is to get back on the correct one. And that's my task today, to convince you that values are a disaster for education and for culture, and that we should leave Tasmania united in our attempts to put fledgling virtues back in the nest and exclude the cuckoos that are peeping and flapping around us, peering over the nest's edges and gloating at the virtues gasping for breath far below. In his literal translation of Plato's Republic, in fact, Alan Bloom notes in the introduction that some translations of Plato have translated the good, bonum or bona, as values. And Bloom says that the translators themselves seem not to be aware that for contemporaries, values is the language of preference. And it's assumed by those who use it that these preferences are bound to be largely, if not entirely, personal. The values world, call it that, is one in which two axioms predominate. The first, you have your values and I have mine. Every kid knows this. All my students know this. You have your values, I have mine. And the second one, don't force your values on me. This flows from the first point and sets the stage for the personalizing and relativism of whatever is being discussed. Yet how strange that it is not only translators of Plato, classicists, and here one excludes that fine gentleman in the front row here at this colloquium, Dr. Daintree, who is among the elect. But that he would not do this, I'm sure. But these other people make this error. There are those, alas, and they are legion, not just translators, but even philosophers and popes, heaven forfend, that seem to float from values to discussions of objective good as if these are the same thing. They try and use the language of values to bridge from a moral proposition to a culture that actually doesn't accept or understand morality. It's a disaster. It will not work. It's the equivalent of running across a burning bridge. In fact, within Catholicism, that should know better because it maintains the importance of virtues, which are very different things, as a key to the moral life of the person and of culture. Even amongst Catholics, there has been a marked tendency for bishops and some popes to use this language that Grant identified as obscuring or others as bankrupt or corrupt. And we need to attend to this shift. What is going on? At my Catholic university in Sydney, Notre Dame, Australia, there is a prevalence of values speak by those who believe it's a moral language. Let me give you an example of how serious things are in relation to a book that's making the rounds there. In my 2016 Religious Liberty lecture at Notre Dame, I called it following C.S. Lewis's lead in The Abolition of Man, where he referred to a particularly bad book on education as the Green Book. I referred to the Values book as the Red Book. I did so at that time out of deference to those using this book and because I'd not then met the author. I've now had the pleasure of engaging its author face to face and discussing with those further at my university who continue to use her book. Because I have given its hapless author a chance to defend her position, and so weak was her attempt to do so, that I shall now name, and if not shame, for that's not the most useful strategy, at least warn others who may be led astray by this book. It's called Giving Voice to Values by Mary Gentile. And I want to explain to you how it works. But first, George Grant again, from his book Time as History, published in 1969. This is Grant. Everybody uses the word values to describe our making of the world, capitalists and socialists, atheists and avowed believers, scientists and politicians. The word comes to us so platitudinously that we take it to belong to the way things are. It's forgotten that before Nietzsche and his immediate predecessors, men did not think about their actions in that language. They did not think that they made the world valuable, but rather that they participated in its goodness. Now, in giving voice to values, Mary Gentile, the author, has started, and is quite clear that this book is the center of a project, and the project, Giving Voice to Values, or GVV, which is what I'll call it, takes its name from that book. Before discussing this interesting project, it's useful to examine its central claims, for these will enable us to situate the book first within already established moral and philosophical discussion of ethics, and the language of values, but also within some of the challenges facing us around the world today. And my title in this paper is Understanding the Purpose and Drift of Contemporary Cultures. And I want to suggest that this values language is really central to this drift. It's the reason we're not getting to grips with really strong moral critiques of politics, or getting sound medical ethics, or indeed learning how to teach lawyers about justice. In the brief blurb that Dr. Daintree provided us, you'll see that I promised to talk a little bit about techne and telos. This is the Greek distinction between techne, which is really arts or means, how we do something, T-E-C-H-N-E, techne, and telos, which is purpose or ends. So techne are means, telos is the ends. For the Greeks, and for much of philosophy after that, you could only evaluate the means in relation to the ends. And Alistair MacIntyre makes this very clear in After Virtue. What's happened, however, is that techne has swallowed telos, and now everything teaches the techniques, but not what they're for. So, technology, the root of technology, the word technology is techne. Technique, the word is techne. Those are purpose. They're means. They're not purposes. They're how something works, not why, not what it's for. Okay, they're how things, not why things. But purposes, the why things, are essential. Let me give you an example. One of the four cardinal virtues, you'll know your cardinal virtues: justice, wisdom, moderation, and courage. Those are the four cardinal virtues. And the three theological virtues that were said in the Western tradition to perfect the natural virtues, faith, hope, and charity, the greatest of these being charity. Love transforms everything. Love transforms one of those key cardinal virtues, justice. But it only does it if we keep it in connection with justice. If justice becomes merely technique, then we're not teaching the ends of justice itself. So I get my students to tell me in their fourth year what the subjects are that they've studied thus far at university, and they rattle them off: contracts, torts, criminal law, commercial law. And then I say to them, right, now let's, there's no whiteboard here, I'd do this for you, but then I say to them, okay, what are the core moral principles in each subject area? So contract law, it's promise, acceptance, but particularly keeping a promise. Criminal law, guilt and innocence, right and wrong. Tort law, that's negligence. Duty of care. See what's happening here? Duty of care, promises, innocence, guilt, right, wrong. Then we ask them about commercial law. Dead silence. No idea what the moral purpose of a commercial law is. I say, do you think it's profits? They don't like that. It's not sufficiently moral. What might it be then? So we spent some time on this, and we eventually pull out the key things, which are, not surprisingly, that business provides employment. It's, and most importantly, goods. We call them goods because they're good. They're things that we wear if we're fortunate to have spectacular jackets, or things we eat, or things that we live within and keep us warm and in inclement weather, like one might get in Tasmania. In any case, these things are the goods that business produces. How strange, then, that its end, those two things, is not in anyone's mind, even though they've studied law for 4 years. So then I say, okay, now, has your legal education, let's go back and look at this list we've created, has it focused largely on law as techna, or techne, or law as telos? And in every single class, unanimously they say, techne, not telos. So then the question is, well, look, this is law that's supposed to be about the business of justice. That's its end in a society. What kind of justice are we going to have, I ask my students, if it's only technical, it's not teleological? In other words, if it's not a deep evaluation of its moral purposes, how can we really evaluate the means? Now, that's true in every discipline. It's true in medicine. It's true in absolutely every aspect of business, every aspect of culture. In business schools, they're trying to deal with the Enron problem of the lack of real virtue in business by jamming on courses like this one, giving voice to values, using books like this one. And they're band-aid solutions to much more serious problems. They're no solution at all, really. They just cover it over. And if they use values education frameworks, which invariably they do, they're playing into what Grant said was an obscuring language for morality. They're even worse. They're creating confusion under the guise that they're creating a solution, right? So, techna and telos, they have to be understood, they have to be in relationship, but in every discipline, doesn't matter what it is, techniques are now swallowing telos, and we don't discuss what the ends are. So in medicine, techniques of medicine become spectacular, become extraordinary. But what is a human person? What is it to really be well? What is health? It's more than just physical well-being. We know that in a society in which the sale of antidepressants is ever on the rise because anxiety and anguish are the big thing. When young people in droves think that they're in the wrong body, something's happened. Something profound has happened. And we're looking at some strange set of explanations for our own internal anxieties. I'm unhappy because I'm obviously the wrong sex. I'm actually the other sex. No matter what nature tells me, I'm in the wrong place. This is the kind of thing you get when you separate reason from nature, reason from reflection, reason from a sense of the good, the objectively true. Aristotle said in the Politics that the student of politics must first understand something. And it's paradoxical to us now to hear this, but it's really profound. He said the student of politics must first understand the soul. Well, that's not something that most politicians have really thought a lot about in terms of their work as politicians. Partly because techniques of politics have driven out the telos of politics. Fits for every discipline, including, by the way, theology. You can become increasingly adept at exegesis or hermeneutics, but not have any clue what the sanctified life means, personally or culturally. So this is a profound thing I'm trying to describe here, the swallowing of telos by techna. And values is key to it. So in the paper that I'll provide, David, for eventual publication, there's a lot of material I obviously can't go into in a oral presentation of this sort. But let me just give you a flavor of this giving voice to values and why I think it's so disastrous. The first claim of the book and the project is that it will help people learn and be empowered, that's her word, to speak your mind when you know what's right. Sounds good. In fact, that's the book's subtitle, How to Speak Your Mind When You Know What's Right. So at least in relation to intention, the book seeks a connection between the person, the dilemma, and the idea of what's right, and seeks to improve the role of individual employees and corporate culture in so doing. GVV, however, is not a moral project, if by moral we mean one that employs shared moral meanings in relation to an end. What's key here is the justification for the project. The book sees itself as part of a movement for what is called values-based action and wishes to transform the foundational assumptions of the teaching of practical principled management so as to, quote, equip future business leaders to know what's right and how to make it happen, unquote. And what is this right, since the moral appeal of the term right is obviously important? Here, the careful reader of the book is likely to come away perplexed, if not downright troubled. You see, we are told that both the terms ethics and morals were rejected for the project, and the reasons for this rejection are interesting. First, the book rejects the term ethics because these are viewed as externally imposed rules and their connection with seemingly sophistic reasoning exercises. Morals, on the other hand, are rejected because even though standards of right and wrong conduct, while, quote, relevant to what we are talking about, unquote, emphasize rightness and wrongness of a particular behavior, quote, more than we feel about that behavior, unquote. That is, the emphasis is on judgment and discipline more than on affirmative pursuit of desired goals and objects, says the author. She doesn't want that. While noting that all these terms overlap, the distinctions drawn here have as much to do with tone as with substance, but that tone is important. So the next section of the book says that the fundamental stance of the project is values-driven action that amounts to alignment, which is defined as moving with our highest aspirations and our deepest sense of who we wish to be, rather than a stance of coercion and stern judgment or of moving against our inclinations, unquote. We mustn't move against our inclinations. We must do what we want to do. And what we want to do is defined by us, not an external rule, not a structure of ethics or of morals, because those are, quote, judgmental, unquote, and, quote, aspirational, unquote. Then yet this book is being used at a Catholic university because it sounds good until you drill down a bit and start to put the pieces together and realize that it's snake oil that's for sale. By the way, when I put this paper that I'm presenting to you to the author of the book, all I got was a look that in Canada we describe as a deer in the headlights. No response, except the lame argument that I didn't understand her project. After I'd gone through in molecular detail quoting her project to her. So the only way of explaining this is that there's a confusion at the core of even the authors and the people using the book as to what it's really doing. Because there's a genuine loss of a sense of the framework of morality. What is the good? How is it to be pursued? And the fact that our natures are not necessarily in alignment with what's good, and like it or not, sometimes we have to change. That's the problem. Values takes the self and inflates it, and takes the external world and deflates it. And this fits with what Lewis said in the introduction to in one of his essays. He said that the history of philosophy for some centuries had been in the direction of the inflation of the subject and a deflation of the object. Fits perfectly to this new values world. So, with respect to the meaning of value itself, we are informed that the word value refers to the inherent worth and quality of a thing or an idea, and we often talk about valuing a challenging job, a comfortable lifestyle, or even a well-made piece of clothing. However, the values we are discussing here are, in fact, values that most people would agree have a moral or ethical aspect to them. I'm quoting the book here. In this sense, these values are actually much the same as what we mean by virtues. It's just that we are approaching them from a self-motivated, aspirational stance rather than a judgmental or self-disciplinary proposition. The word value is both a noun and a verb. It has inherent in it not only the concept of goodness, like virtue, but also the act of wanting, desiring, or personally valuing something. So the choice of the term values is about tone and positioning as well as literal definition. And it goes on and on and on in this kind of bumbling, giving with one hand and taking away with the other, rejecting aspiration, rejecting judgment, and yet affirming what it calls right action. But it doesn't make any sense. Okay, so I've focused on this to make this point. Values are said to be different from ethics and morals, as they are non-judgmental and self-aspirational rather than judgmental and self-disciplinary. And these are essentially based on feelings. And the list of things such as honesty, self-respect, and fairness are seen as widely shared values, but not in any way related to or distinguished from the hard work of conforming habits to virtues that the virtue tradition took as a common starting point. In short, the GVV project has chosen the language and strategies of the will, but without any moral tradition of the virtues. What they are, how they are approached, and what is necessary in order to understand and gauge one's moral development. These things are left completely undeveloped. GVV could be said to be virtues light, except that it isn't really about virtues at all. Okay. So the problem then is that virtues are avoided in any detailed way. There's no description, as I gave a minute ago, of the four cardinal virtues. Cardinal from cardes, on the hinge on which everything turns. There's no discussion of the objective goods of justice, wisdom, moderation, and courage. None of that. What's key is my choices. Me, I, the quotidian self. It's all about what I want, not about the thing that's being chosen. In the context of shared being. There's no community in this. You force through in the organization your what you believe to be right, but it's right not because it's right, but because it's what you want. So there's a strange kind of, as Grant said, obscuring moral language being used here. And it's relativized. As I said at the beginning, those two axioms. I have my values, you have yours, I have mine. And don't push yours on me. That's what's happening in here. Interestingly, if you look up in the index, the term virtues, it says virtues, see values. So the, what is it, Ouroboros? What's the thing that eats its own tail? Ouroboros. Okay. I think I've done a sufficient job on the red book. I would like, however, to mention that George Orwell, in his very important 1946 essay, Politics in the English Language, lists values as one of the list of meaningless words. And it might interest you to know what else he lists as meaningless words. He lists the words equality, progressive, as well. He points out that these things tend towards an authoritarianism because they're unaccountable. What politicians don't love values? They can stand at any rostrum and invoke Australian values, and the entire room of Australians will, completely agree with you, yes. But what is being talked about is completely opaque. Whose values? Which values? Just ask a specific question after the general bromide, and everyone will fall apart. For example, who's in favor of Australian values? Answer, yes, everybody. We believe in them. Yes, we do. And what about pro-life? Oops. Pro-choice. Oops. Suddenly, the minute you get specific, the room fragments, right? So there are these values are doing exactly what Grant said they're doing. They're obscuring moral discourse. And they're providing a non-accountability to politics. The reason politics loves the language of values is because it doesn't offer any specific thing at all. Perfect for amoral politics is the confusing morality of values language. Now here's what Alistair MacIntyre, I promised you a bit of MacIntyre in the brief description. He says that empowerment, feelings, the non-judgmentalism that we saw in this GVV project, they all fit into what he calls emotivism in his landmark book, After Virtue. McIntyre reminds us that emotivism is, quote, the doctrine that all evaluative judgments, and more specifically all moral judgments, are nothing but expressions of preference, expressions of attitude or feeling, insofar as they are moral or evaluative in character, unquote. That's exactly what the GVV project is all about. That's what we've seen in what I read you from it. Elsewhere in After Virtue, McIntyre addresses the attempt at various times in history to suggest that the virtues are nothing but those qualities which we happen to find generally pleasant or useful. Commenting upon this, what he called odd suggestion, McIntyre notes, quote, what we find generally pleasant or useful will depend on what virtues are generally possessed and cultivated in our community. Hence, the virtues cannot be defined or identified in terms of the pleasant or useful, unquote. Contemporary business studies, like contemporary studies in just about everything, have generally lost any connection to their disciplines as moral, and in so doing must find something that stands in for moral evaluation. That's what GVV is doing in elevating values to a series of manipulative techniques. Starting with a non-judgmental, completely self-generated set of values, cut off from any necessarily objective sense of obligation, for that would be judgmental, the values may or may not be related to anything at all, since their grounding is based on personal choices rather than choices in relation to any objective virtues. GVV finds that many people are pragmatists and then wants to appeal to their pragmatic side. But what, we may ask, do we do with those who simply want to maximize their own stake in a corporate world that has gone off the moral rails, such as Enron did some years ago? The GVV project, in avoiding the necessity of a moral understanding for business, plays into relativism. It doesn't challenge it at its root. Now, the list of people who've written about values language and its corruption is huge. Gertrude Himmelfarb, John Rist, as I mentioned, the Canadian author, the late Peter Emberley, Edward Andrews wrote a book called The Genealogy of Values, Alan Bloom, I mentioned already, recently Pierre Manon. Interestingly, Heidegger, in his essay on humanism, talks about values language as being the enemy of being, because he says when we turn the, in a sense, the, he doesn't use this word for it, but it's the numinous, the holy dimension of being, into a commodity conception like value, its price, we actually attack being at its core. And he's right about that. We do that. So there's a long list, and yet we are using it in the Catholic Church. It's terrifying what's happened to us. This is a big language within Catholic education. When I acted for the Catholic School Trustees as their lawyer in Canada some years ago, all through the materials, one was reading about values, like a corrosive drip. So you've asked me to address something related to culture, and I hope I've done that. I hope I've pointed out the problem of values. I would like, however, to say this. I'll conclude by reference to Morris Cowling's wonderful analysis of John Stuart Mill, who, of course, was one of the fathers of liberalism. Liberalism has, says John Gray recently in a fabulous book called Two Faces of Liberalism, has always had two streams. One stream views toleration as a temporary way station towards eventual agreement. The other stream views disagreement as an ongoing necessity because of how our starting points. The first one views everything as eventual convergence. The second one needs modus vivendi, how we live together when we disagree. Gray says that the future of genuine liberalism depends on its turning its back on the first idea, convergence liberalism. But it's convergence liberalism that animates much in contemporary human rights, much in contemporary Bill of Rights and identity debates, whether it's LGBT or you name it, Black Lives Matter. All of these movements are what William Galston, the American political philosopher, calls civic totalism. people who wish to claim the sole moral view for the civic sphere. They're civic totalists. They're not liberals. But they use the dynamic of liberalism to advance their controlling agendas. Now, Mill said a fascinating thing in his book on one of his writings about philosophy. He said this, and Hugo Menel quotes him, in his system of logic, Hugo Menel, in his book on Marx, points out how Mill describes the need to redefine a term that has ceased to have any determinative meaning due to its becoming applied to a heterogeneous collection of things with nothing in common. If the term isn't redefined, according to Mill, the heterogeneous term is no longer of any use in thought and communication. It ceases to have any real validity or use. So quite apart from my excoriating the term for its subjective relativism, the glib father of liberalism, that stunning elitist J.S. Mill himself, provides a strong argument for values being well past its best by date. Thanks very much.
That was Dr. Ian Benson with Understanding the Purpose and the Drift of Contemporary Cultures. This presentation was part of the Christopher Dawson Center for Cultural Studies 2017 colloquium on the theme, Liberal Education, Restoring the Notion of Education as the Basis for Living the Good Life, which was hosted in Hobart, Australia. For more talks, interviews, and shows, visit cradio.org.au.